All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
And welcome back to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put them all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me, shaking his head abhorrently, is Editor-in-Chief Rich Jalise.
And seated across the microphone from me, who decided since she's drinking scotch, she's going to talk with a Scottish accent.
Fuck you.
Film buff online, contributing editor, and Miss Congeniality, Natasha Bogutsky.
Thank you. Sorry, I had to swallow first.
Okay, then, moving on.
Hi, guys. Welcome back. It's been months.
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, we've been, for the best reasons, though. We've been busy with film festivals where we've had. Our short films are screening. You've had a short one-act play that was produced in a night of one acts, which was wonderful. And it was a great script. I mean, I had read it from like first draft to what it eventually wound up on stage. But it was really well executed by you and the rest of that cast.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a rough script. By the time I was done with it, I turned to everyone. I was like, I think I'm taking a sabbatical.
You were exercising some demons.
Oh yeah.
I think it's safe to say that. Without getting into the details.
I think I pretty much stated on this podcast before that my mom can be a cunt.
Well, that's...
I said can be, not always is.
Okay, that's splitting a hair.
That's how I cover my ass.
That's okay then. But, yeah, let's see. We are a minute into this and oh my God.
We said F and C at the same
time. We are all off the rail.
Woo-hoo!
Oh my God.
They've missed us.
We are off the rails like a train in a Buster Keaton film.
So what you're saying is Denzel Washington and Chris Pine couldn't stop this.
No. No, we're about to slam into that bus with Harrison Ford.
Wow. Those are two really deep cuts.
Next time, if I go down to North Carolina with you guys again.
No, I am not doing the trek out for The Fugitive. I hear so much about Darren.
And I will go and just see that myself if necessary.
Darren's brother was there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
wait, when they shot it?
I think so, yeah.
Oh.
David? Brian.
Oh, Brian. Okay.
I
look forward to talking to him about that at some point in space and time.
Yes. I think he was there or he wasn't he wasn't far from it when it was shot. And Taryn loves to tell me that every freaking time. I just watched The Fugitive for the first time over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time ever. Mm-hmm. And of course that happens. And he's just like, I'm like, yeah, I know.
He wasn't even in the room. He just had head pops.
He was sitting right next to me, okay. And he was quiet. It was like the Aragorn broke his toe section
of family history.
Yeah, he's like, did you know? I'm like, yes, I know. Shut up. Let me enjoy the movie because right now I'm not.
That is a great way to describe that. That's hilarious.
The Aragorn broke his toe. Yes.
Moment of The Fugitive.
Yes.
In my household. Yes.
Did you know? Yes, I did. Shut up.
That's hilarious. Anyways, that's sort of what we're going to be the topic of today's episode, which I'm pretty much going to call what we did on our summer vacation.
Oh, The Runaway Train. Got it.
Yes. Well, Runaway Train is a really good movie.
I did not know that was a movie.
Yes, there is. It's on the Plex server.
And we can't call it The Runaway, otherwise, you know, Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning will show up with Michael Shannon to scream at us.
That'd be cool, though. I mean, imagine getting screamed at by Michael Shannon.
I'm okay with getting screamed at by Michael Shannon. I just don't want the other two in the room.
I've interviewed a hungover Michael Shannon, but...
I know.
Yeah, that's one of my all-time favorite pictures from any New York Comic Con I've ever done. But anyways, as I was saying, what we did on our summer vacation, and part of that was going to some filming locations. You went to Paris.
I did, yes.
I think we briefly mentioned it before in like the one episode we did in July.
That I had gone, or that, no, if it was in July, I had already went.
So. Yeah, you had already gone, and we're back.
We're going, yeah.
Yeah. So let's start with that, because you went, you got out of the country, and that got me off of my butt to go across country myself.
I'm so proud of you for that.
Yeah, because...
For me, it was my first ever vacation. I had taken weekend trips. Mm-hmm. I had taken like 3-4 days somewhere. Like three, I think, was the max that mm-hmm. I had ever taken in my life, where I wasn't working something like New York Comic Con or Tribeca Film Festival or something. So this was just my first, I'm getting the hell away. My first time in Europe, my first time in Paris, my first ever vacation. I went by myself.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of firsts. And I am so happy that somehow that inspired you to do something that you've wanted to do for almost 2 decades.
That's true. I have some economic anxiety. And that was really the biggest hurdle for me to... I mean, I've had this file folder here on my desk for years, filled with places to go in LA, things I wanted to do, things I wanted to see.
And I made it even worse by buying you that book for Christmas.
You bought me a World Film Locations in Los Angeles book, which was great, which went with me, as well as another... As well as another book that I had about locations in LA. Both of those went with me. And like I said, though, I've always had like economic anxiety of like, oh, my God, I'm going to get out there and something's going to happen and I'm suddenly going to be broke and I can't get back and I'm going to be stuck in LA and I'm going to have to live on the streets and
you've got
sell
friends
my blood for
who,
food.
You have, you know? Friends who would be willing to help you. And that's the thing that you always got to take into consideration. Some people who don't have a good support group around them. My family is shit, but my friends are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that if I was in dire straits, my friends would somehow pull together and turn me into George Bailey.
Yeah, same here. Exactly. I know that.
There's no way that I or Darren would ever leave you stranded in LA.
I know that.
Yeah.
I know that. I love you guys for that, too. But... You know, part of me was always like, what if something happens? You know, and I didn't want, you know me, I don't like to put anybody out.
Okay. You want to talk about financial anxiety for a second? I got to mention this.
Okay.
My car shit the bed this past week.
Uh-huh.
As in, it needed a whole new turbo engine, and the car was not worth that amount to put a turbo engine into it when a turbo engine is going to be upwards of $5,000. And I turned around and the first words out of my mouth to Darren once that car had been diagnosed was, I wish I hadn't gone to Paris.
Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that if like in the next, anything that happens that's going to cost me like more than $1,000 in the next year, I'm going to be like, oh, God, I shouldn't have gone to LA. I would have had the money better. You know,
yeah,
or something
that's
like
exactly
that.
Yeah. My reaction. And he looked at me and he goes, don't do that to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so proud of you for taking that trip and doing it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to put things in perspective for a moment. Yes, I didn't have the money to fix my car.
Yeah.
But instead, we got a whole damn new one, which is even better.
Mm-hmm.
And that one will keep me for, you know, at least 5 years, if not longer, mm-hmm. while the other one would have just been shaking and rattling on its last leg. So, yeah, it was a smart play.
And going, I mean, I got to hit a number of things that I'll talk about in a little bit, especially a few locations I have literally saw 40 years ago in the movies and was like, at some point,
the place
I need
you
to go
stayed
there.
Was a movie location. Fuck
That's
off.
That's true, too. I didn't realize how much history the Biltmore in Los Angeles has. And we'll get to that in a moment.
That's going to be 15 minutes alone. And I will just shut up the entire time.
Anyway. As opposed to me talking now.
No, I just mean I will shut up and I won't. I'll just let you rant.
Thank you.
Because you're going to rant.
Yeah, I am. So that was like a hurdle for me to overcome. But I'm glad we both were able to do that. And I mean, you messaged me and called me once or twice from Paris, which was funny because like it'll be like the middle of the afternoon for me and you'll be on video chat or whatever and in a taxi and I'm looking at you, but also behind you I can see out the taxi window and it's dark and street lights and everything, and I'm like, it's 1:30, what the yeah.
And for me I think it was like around 7 or 8 p.m.
yeah.
No, it was a five-hour time difference.
Well, whatever it was for me. But it was like evening and the lights were coming on and I was getting to see the parrot. I remember at one point I was like, you're like, oh, it's really lovely. And you're like still holding the phone on you. And I'm like, well, point the phone out the window. Let me see, for goodness sakes.
Oh, one of my personal favorites was...
You're a terrible documentary director.
I know. Oh, that's why I hate docs.
yeah, fair.
So the one that I will never forget was I had tried to get to the Basilica de Sacre-Cœur for Mass on a Sunday, and it sucked, and I wasn't able to get there. So the next day... I had planned to get up early, go over to the beginning of the Champs-Élysées, walk my way up it, shot my way up the Champs-Élysées. And to be honest, the only thing I bought was hand creams from L'Occitane. Get to the Arc de Triomphe, then walk down in towards the Place du Trocadéro, which is right across the river from... the Eiffel Tower. And I'm sorry, guys, don't fucking go to the Eiffel Tower. One, you can get mugged. Two, Yay. It's too many tourists, which means you could get mugged. And three, your best views is going to be from the Place du Trocadéro, which was in John Wick, which is in Anna. Like, so, it's a movie location in itself.
Yeah, so you didn't run up the Eiffel Tower and do, like, Roger Moore in A View to a Kill or anything like that?
I didn't touch the damn metal that it's made out of.
Okay.
So right in front of it, there is a bridge, and it leads straight to the Place du Trocadéro. Mm-hmm. You're going to get the best views there. And most times, when I went, there were... unfortunately, a few other people, because one, the secret is starting to get out, and two, it was around the time of everything was getting set up for the Olympics. So
that had to
there
have
was
been...
a lot of shits just covered in bleachers. The Palais Royal was getting redone, so that was all blocked off. Across the Pont Alexandre Trois Bridge, there was massive bleachers. It was just everywhere.
But, you know, for the purposes of the podcast, though, I kind of want to keep this...
Yeah, movie-related.
Movie-related a little bit. And, yeah, I mean, you're setting a scene, which is nice.
And I called... But thing is, by the time I was done, I called you, and it was about 1:30 in the afternoon. I was walking along the left bank of the Seine, and you were just getting up at 7 a.m.
Yeah, sorry.
That's what I was getting
to. Okay. but you're in the City of Lights, City of Culture, City of History. And you still went to the movies, though.
Twice, actually.
Yes. Which was the first movie you went to?
Well, hold on.
Okay.
Before I get to the first movie that I went to, which was on my first night in Paris, I landed at noon. Was at my hotel before 2 o'clock, got changed, got cleaned up, put away all of my, you know, belongings, hung up my clothes, and then I hit the streets. I walked an hour and a half to my first ever dinner in Paris, which was a movie location. It was the restaurant called Le Grand Colbert, and it is from the end of Nancy Meyers' Something's Gotta Give, the famous chicken scene with...
Yes.
Diane Keaton, Jack Nicholson, and Keanu Reeves happen there? And I was so antsy. I was starting to feel like, what have I done? Was this a bad idea?
The trip itself?
Yes. I was having major anxiety about being there alone and having a language barrier. And the thing is my French is not bad. It's actually really freaking good. I took 3 years in school.
You were brushing up for months before you went.
Yes, I was. I even hired a little bit of a tutor.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know that.
Our friend Mike.
Oh, okay.
Who had spent...
I know you'd been practicing with him.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that was
He was tutoring me. And so we would sit for hours and just go over it. Or he would find things and send them to me. He still does to keep me engaged now that I've been. But I was sitting there going... I think this is a huge mistake. I made an emotional judgment. I'm in a country, you know, thousands of miles away. What the fuck have I done? And then the host came up to me. His name was Jacques. And he said, your French is better than you think. More confidence. And by the time I was done with my meal, I said to myself, I'm going to the movies. Because that is a place where I always feel comfortable no matter where I am. So I didn't go very far from my hotel, maybe about a 20-minute walk, and I went and saw Furiosa opening weekend in Paris, motherfuckers.
Okay. So how does the French movie going experience differ from going to see Furiosa at our local Cinemark or one's local AMC or whatever Cineplex?
So, to give you guys a heads up, there are cinemas all over Paris. But here's the thing. Most of them don't show the newest releases.
It's a lot of rep?
No, more. So, here's the thing. Around us, you're going to find a lot of the big blockbusters. Mm-hmm. Even in the little houses, because they know that's what's going to bring in the money. Over there... they have a completely different mindset about it. New movies don't bring in the money that old movies do. There are art house theaters all over the city. Most of them show on film. Not on digital, on fucking film.
I'm filling out my passport application already.
And they show older films. I ended up at the Pathé Theater in the 14th arrondissement seeing Furiosa, and a ticket to see Furiosa was 30 euro.
Okay.
That is fucking expensive.
Yes. I was going to say, can you remember off the top of your head what the conversion rate is on that? Or
So it was like 24 euro, which equaled out to about $30.
Oh, $30. Okay.
To see for one ticket. I'm glad that I was already full from dinner because I wouldn't even want to try.
I was going to say, did you take a look at the concession stand to see what kind of different snacks they might have?
I did not, but the way that their theater was set up was really interesting.
Okay.
It was multi-leveled, as in you had to walk up levels of stairs, and on each level there was like two theaters. Two or three theaters on each level. So it was like one on either side and one in the middle. But it was a winding staircase to go all the way up.
Okay. Structurally, that sounds very similar to like the AMC 25 Empire on 42nd Street in New York City that I've been in a couple of times over the decades.
Possibly, yeah.
And where you go up escalators and each floor has like, it's 1, 2, and 3, and then house number 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
That
9.
Would be exactly how it was.
Was it a more modern building in construction, or was it like an older building?
It was modern. It was super modern, really sleek, lots of grays and metal. And yeah, I really felt like it was top notch. Probably it only been open a couple years. By the time I got done with the film, it was 1 a.m., and then I had to walk back to my hotel. I walked a half an hour, and it was amazing. I just put in, like, an earbud, and I'm going to teach you guys a little trick. If you're ever alone in a city that you don't know, just
put it in an earbud, set it up to your, you know, your maps on Google or Apple or Waze or whatever it is that you want to use. Turn on some music. And when you need to make a change on a street, it's going to break into your music say, turn right. It's going to be the same as if you're driving. And no one will know that you don't know the city.
Ah, yes. And you have, I mean, I have short guy hair. You have longer hair. So you can always even just hide the,
yeah,
the ear
that's
thing
exactly what
know,
I did.
Underneath some hair.
Mm-hmm. And it was useful. I did it all the time. Yeah. By the time I got back to my hotel, it was about 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. And I felt at home in Paris.
Good.
It kind of really kind of warmed me up to it.
Good. I'm glad that I would you say that go well let me yeah let me retract here for a second. Would you say that going to the cinema helped with that adjustment period?
Having a French person tell me that I just needed to have a little more confidence, because mm-hmm. that's the secret to being okay, that helped. And then also to go somewhere that no matter what city I am in, mm-hmm. makes me feel like I'm at home. Yeah, it helped. Good. And there were a couple other times throughout the my time in Paris where I needed that comfort. So I sought it out.
Well, let me ask you this then. Furiosa itself, not a lot of dialogue, but was it a dubbed film into Mm-mm. French, or was there subtitles of in French?
Neither.
Really?
It was pure English.
Wow.
So when I was trying to decide where I wanted to go, it was mm-hmm. between that and Rome, and more people speak English in France than they do, or in Paris than they do in Rome. So that was a big factor, because I was like, my first time going overseas, I wanted to make certain that if I did finally hit
a
wall,
yeah,
if I didn't hit a wall, I would still be okay to say, can I, you know, switch.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that cinema was definitely, we show American movies, we show English movies, they are not dubbed, and they are not subtitled.
Okay. Could you get a vibe? Was it like a lot of tourists who are going? Was it more Parisians, a nice mix, or?
So the theater was not super packed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was packed, but it wasn't like crazy. It wasn't. And it seemed like it was a mix, but definitely more French, because that is technically a residential neighborhood. Most people who are tourists usually stay around the Seine area, where all the, you know, the big monuments and the museums are. Where I was very much a residential neighborhood near the outskirts of Paris. And when you say outskirts of Paris, I mean, it's an hour walk and all of a sudden you're at the Louvre. Like, it's not that crazy, but yeah.
So what was it like being a contributor to the foreign box office of a film?
It sucked.
Oh?
The
presentation wasn't great, or?
No, it was great. It just, I felt like I had wasted a good 30 euro on something that, as a film consumer, I probably should have been spending a little more attention to. Like, as I was walking up those staircases, they had different posters. Mm-hmm. And one of them was for the new Count of Monte Cristo coming out of Pathé.
Yes.
And by the way, this was a Pathé cinema. Mm-hmm. And my brain went, when is that dropping? Is that in right now? Should I go back downstairs? I'll spend another 30 euro and go to a different movie. And then I saw it wasn't coming out for like a week. I missed it by a week, and I was pissed.
I had a similar experience.
Because I saw the Pathé French Three Musketeers movies that recently came out, and they were amazing. And I was like, I love Count of Monte Cristo. I love that story. I love the books.
He makes a mean sandwich.
I love the Jim Caviezel film. Mm-hmm. I just love that story. And so I really wanted to see what France was going to be doing with it, considering the last time that Alexandre Dumas' work had been translated over there hasn't been for more than 3 decades.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I got stuck seeing American films the entire time I was there.
Okay. Well, let's get to that second film that you saw. Because
that was a movie-heavy day.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning then, because we're just trying to keep to the movie stuff. How did that day start off movie-wise then?
I got to really state why I ended up changing my plans and I ended up there that day.
Okay.
So this was Sunday, and I had tried to get to Basilica de Sacré-Cœur in Montmartre in the 18th. And I only made it to the 10th in my Uber because streets were blocked off for Olympics preps. People were very upset. My Uber driver, after 25 minutes, turned around to me and said, "C'est impossible." And I was like, okay, I understand. Bon ici, super. Like, just let me out here. This is good. And I walked my ass down to the Opera House, then grabbed another Uber, and I took it. I was like, I need a pick-me-up. Take me to the Cinémathèque Française.
Aha.
One of the first ever museums of cinema in the world.
Now, this was on your checklist of places to visit.
It was. And they were actually doing a retrospective of James Cameron while I was there. Like, they were showing James Cameron films. But I didn't go there for that. I went there for one reason, one reason only. Inside La Cinémathèque Française is another museum. It's small, but it's very integral. It is the Millet's Museum. Rich, would you like to hop in and now explain Georges Millet?
Pioneer in cinema, created an entire language of visual effects that was used pretty much up until digital stuff in the last 20 years.
Still being used.
It's still being used in some cases. Just adapted for digital.
Mm-hmm.
And just an amazing, amazing innovator and storyteller. You've all seen at least a little bit of, you know, A Trip to the Moon with the moon with the actual human face in there and
the rocket ship
gets stuck in the eye.
Yep.
But he's done so many things, so many marvelous things, and thankfully a lot of that's been preserved. And I know you have been a fan of his work forever.
Ever since I saw Hugo by Martin Scorsese. Most people completely forget that that film exists in Scorsese's long list of legacy. And it hurts me inside. And funny enough, where I stayed in the 14th is called Montparnasse. And there is a Georges Millet link there.
Oh.
After his studio went under and a lot of his films got melted down and everything, he spent the end of his years in La Gare de Montparnasse, in the train station, which we see in Hugo.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not make it to that train station, unfortunately, and I wish I had because that would have been a great link. But my time at the Millet's Museum was eye-opening. I took photos of every plaque that I could find that explained so much. I saw cameras that are over 100 years old. And everything is very interactive, too. So you could play with optics. You got to see exactly how some of the illusions in the backgrounds were created and how they have been updated. There is work by Guillermo del Toro and Christopher Nolan and so many others that have been influenced heavily by his work. At the end of my trip there was a room. And I took a lot of photos, a lot of video. This room held nothing but a bench and a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And on that screen for over 30 minutes was just a montage of all the work that had been influenced by Georges Millet, from Nolan to Terry Gilliam, Andrei Tarkovsky, Kubrick, Lucas, Cameron. I started to cry, and I just couldn't stop myself for probably a good 10 minutes. Like, I left and my eyes were just bloodshot.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much a true religious experience. I was so pleased that I didn't end up at Basilica du Sacré-Cœur. But I still went to church on Sunday. I went to the place that mattered the most to me. And I've always stated that the cinema is where I went to worship. To worship ideas and imagination and what the human brain is capable of. And the worlds that we can create.
Mm-hmm.
Not the worlds that we visit. The worlds that we can actually be gods over. That we can create. That we can give everyone else an escape to from their lives. I'll never be able to see something like that again. Maybe I'm wrong. And I hope to God I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But to stand there in a place that's over 100 years old, to see how far one's legacy, even when they don't know it themselves, can stretch.
I had similar experiences on my trip, too. But I kind of don't want to jump in yet with my stuff because
I'm almost done.
Yeah, we're still working on Paris here. So,
and after I left there, I walked quite a way. So I was in Bercy in the 18th, which is on the right bank. And I walked all the way into the 5th and 6th arrondissement, which is the left bank, otherwise known as the Latin Quarter, and into where like the Sorbonne University and all that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up walking up a street and I found this little tiny indie cinema house, as in they had two screens, a massive marquee out front, only one little box office holder in the middle, and you know, you split off. And it was like those movie theaters you see in cinemas all the time, the little tiny ones.
And the little box office right out front.
That's
a booth.
But you never see those. You see them in the movies, but you never see them in real life. And just out of curiosity, I looked at the list of what they had been playing and what they were going to be playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great experience when I saw this list. They were playing The Deer Hunter, the original Suspiria,
ooh,
Possession, Strange Days with Ralph Fiennes, The Usual Suspects, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Darjeeling Unlimited, True Romance, Virgin Suicide, The Big Lebowski, and The Wicker Man. The original Wicker Man.
Blah! That's a hell of a lineup over a couple of days.
Those were... And Casino.
Oh, yeah.
Those were the American movies that they were showing, which usually was more at night.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, they would show... I saw, and I missed it, Cleo 5 to 7.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. They were showing a lot of more French New Wave and international sectors from, say, Italy and Greece and all that. What I had missed with Cleo 5 to 7, I gained. Because the next movie that they were showing was The Big Heat from 1953 with Glenn Ford and Gloria Graham.
Yes, an amazing film, a classic film.
One of my favorites.
You used that as a bit of research for one of our short films.
I did.
Where you told an actor to go watch it.
Yes,
I
did.
So,
yes, I did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I walked down the street, had a drink, came back in an hour, bought my ticket, which was less than 10 euro.
Nice.
And as I was standing on the front stoop, because they had nowhere to sit because there's no lobby, I actually saw the projectionist booth open. And I saw him actually hooking up the film.
So it was a 35mm print.
Film, yes.
Okay, that was going to be my next question is, were all of these being projected from prints or were they digital packages? But
I don't know
film,
if all of
film.
Them, but that one definitely was. That one was print and it was amazing.
Really good quality print?
Incredible quality print. I know you guys can't see this, but Rich.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yes.
I did take a photo of just the title card from where I was sitting, and it was very small.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been 10 rows in that theater.
Okay. How many people were there, do you think?
There were so many people there.
Oh, good.
There were more people there than there were for Furiosa by comparison of the size of the theater.
Huh.
So Furiosa was a theater that was seating over probably 200.
Mm-hmm.
And there maybe was about 40 people, maybe 50 people there. This is a theater that seated maybe 60 or 70. And there was about 40 people in that theater. So it was a strong number.
Wow. That sounds great, though.
And that's how I noticed how people really appreciate art. They don't appreciate so much how where we are, mm-hmm. as so much where we came from. And I love that so much, because you can't create, you can't innovate without knowing your past.
Yes.
What about you?
Okay, here we go.
Oh, boy.
Well, I had a week in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I went out with that folder I mentioned before, full of things I wanted to do and places to go and things. And ultimately, though, I didn't push myself to do all of those things on that list. A, because, hey, need an excuse to go back. But also, I had been feeling so stressed for the last several months about various things that I was like, why am I going to go on a vacation and put a continent between me and all that stress? Only to give myself a different kind of stress for 8 days. So, you know, I got out there and nice flight, uneventful. I read the entirety of the book about the making of Airplane, one of my all-time favorite movies. And
did you watch any movies at all on your flight?
I did not.
I did on the way back. We'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I figured if I'm going to be flying in an airplane, I should read the book about the movie Airplane.
So I actually watched Airplane the night before I left.
Oh, jeez. I hope they didn't offer you fish for your in-flight meal.
They did on the flight back because it was from Iceland Air.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I actually did eat the fish, and it was pretty fucking tasty. I'm not going to lie. The way that it was done was, yeah, Icelandic. Pretty good.
Mm-hmm. But so anyways, it's a breezy read, by the way, the book, if you're interested in picking it up. And so I get to L.A., land, literally, you know, I'm, go through. I was disappointed that the hallway from from arrivals to luggage pickup was not one of the ones that are done over in all the colored tiles that you see in, well, an Airplane or the President's Analyst or Jackie Brown.
That was 30 years ago. Come on, it's been
Some of those hallways are still like that.
Oh.
Yeah, there's like, I think they did like, I remember researching this like when I got there. They did like 7 hallways that way, and I think 5 are still available, something like that. And I was like, I was a little disappointed. I was like, damn it. But, you know, I literally walk out of the terminal to find the thing to get me to the hotel.
Jackie Brown. Sorry.
To get me to the hotel. And literally, I see, you know, that 60s double arched control tower that they no longer use.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, that's LAX to me. You know? It's like one of those, oh shit, I'm here. You know, I am here. Cool. Awesome. And so I get to the hotel. And I gave myself a day to kind of like acclimate, drive around a little bit. You know, so I drove up to Griffith Observatory, but there was a concert at the Greek Theater, which is like right there. So like traffic and everything was a mess. So I like kind of like, yeah, I'll come back another day. And, you know, drove a little bit down Sunset Strip, stopped at a pizza place for dinner. And, you know, just kind of like checking out the vibe. You know, and I was like, oh, this is really nice. This is cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess first thing I'm going to talk about is, I stayed at the Millennium Biltmore Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. This is not a plug.
No, it is very much a movie location.
Yes, very much. If you've seen Chinatown, Bachelor Party.
A little film called
Beverly Hills Cop.
Well, I wasn't going to go with that one, but yeah.
Ghostbusters.
That's the one.
Buckaroo Banzai. So right there, it's like five movies I love. And Dr. Detroit. This was a place that was built in the 20s. And right as like people were coming to Hollywood and was starting to, you know, explode as an industry town. And it was the largest hotel west of Chicago. It had 1,000 rooms at one point. They've since done some renovations and stuff. And this is the hotel where they held the first kind of like congratulatory dinner after the Motion Picture Academy was founded.
Hmm.
And they've held Oscar ceremonies in the ballrooms. They've had, lots of films have shot there. Lots of TV shows have shot there. It's so drenched in its own history. There's a little hallway off the Grand Arcade where you can go, and they have pictures of all sorts of things from their history. You know, they'll have like little exhibits, like an old cocktail lounge menu, and then, you know, pictures of Hollywood royalty there. If you go down all the way down at the end of the side corridor off that main history corridor, there's one little picture. And you're looking at it, it's like, who is this young woman? Oh, let's read the... Oh, turns out in the lobby was one of the last places the Black Dahlia was seen before she was murdered. So yeah, there's a little bit of dark history, too. The hotel thrived up until about the 70s, started to decline a little bit, was sold in the late 70s and got renovated, and... I think that's around, you know, after the renovation was like 82, 83, 84. And that's when a lot of movies from that time, like Beverly Hills Cop, Ghostbusters, Dave.
Which I just watched for the first time, Beverly Hills Cop, probably about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. That's the Beverly Palms Hotel movie. So
I recognize the lobby.
From other pictures that I sent you. I think at that point the owners were like, we need to recoup as much money as we can. So now that it's looking really nice here, let's see if we can get some location fees out of some production companies. A lot of stuff shot there. They rearranged part of it. So now the new lobby is the ballroom from Ghostbusters. Literally, you walk in the side, and if you know where you're walking in, or you recognize, I recognize that chandelier, I recognize this layout here. Perhaps if you've watched...
And the flowers are still standing. Sorry.
If you've watched Ghostbusters, close to triple digits. I just kind of walked in, and I went, anybody seen a ghost? You know, I just muttered that to myself. I didn't yell it out through the room, but... I just knew where I was, and I was like, okay, this vacation is here. We're going to have some fun.
I know that feeling because I went to a restaurant from Midnight in Paris, which is one of my favorite films. Yes, I know it's a Woody Allen movie, but that movie gets a pass because it's just, one, it's iconic, and two, it is universal.
And it's not exercising some of his creepier tendencies.
Yeah. It talks kind of more about creation and the love of the past and not appreciating the present. Yeah. And I greatly appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But so the restaurant I went to was called Polidor. And if you guys have seen Midnight in Paris, that is where Tom Hiddleston's F. Scott Fitzgerald takes Owen Wilson to meet Ernest Hemingway for the first time. So I'm sitting there having dinner, and the way it's set up is kind of like cafeteria-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting at these long tables with people that you don't know. I loved it. I loved it because it meant I could talk to a lot of different people I didn't know. But in the back of my head, I could see Corey Stoll sitting in the corner saying, writers are competitive. if I don't like it, I'm not going to like it because it's bad writing. If I do like it, I'm going to be envious even more. You don't want the opinion of another writer. And I was like, whoo.
when we visit locations like that, especially for movies that we really love,
you can see it.
We do see like the ghosts of the movie, you know, no pun intended with Ghostbusters here. So I literally...
You did the same at the Biltmore, I'm sure.
Oh my God, you couldn't turn anywhere in that grand arcade there without like going, oh, okay, I know what happens here.
But
I know
was there a cockroach up on 12?
No.
I know what you're going to say.
There's only 11 floors at the Biltmore, too, which was a little bit disappointing.
It was disappointing for me to hear that.
But I was up on the 9th floor, which is the highest of the hotel rooms. And then 10 and 11 are like ballrooms and meeting rooms and the gym and stuff like that. So I got up as high as one could get in the if you're just staying there, which was nice. And unfortunately, I didn't have a great view. But I wasn't there for the view, really. So like the my first morning there, before I went and drove around, I got up and I walked a couple of blocks to a place that had a lot of different little food stalls, got some breakfast, and I'm sitting there on this little cafe table on the sidewalk, and I'm looking across the street, and it's the Bradbury Building, you know, that we've seen in all sorts of films, from Blade Runner to Wolf to, you know, a number of other films. And I was just like, this is amazing. You know, you can't turn anywhere without looking and seeing something like, oh, that building over there, I think that's the building from Independence Day, where the people in LA are like up top when they get blasted, you know, welcoming the aliens. Over there's, I saw that, and that's from LA Confidential over there. It's crazy driving around and when you suddenly realize you see something, like jumping forward a couple days, I was driving back from doing the Warner Brothers studio tour, and I'm coming up to, Olive Street, heads down onto a T, and, you know, kind of do left to get on the highway to get back to downtown. And I look ahead, and, you know, the road's on a T. I'm, you know, looking straight ahead at this building, and it's like Valhalla Entertainment. And my brain just goes, oh, Gail Ann Hurd, the producer of Walking Dead and hundreds of other things. That's her office right there. Cool. Light turns green. I turn left and I go onto the highway. And it's hard to do, you know, look. You're going to yell at me for this one, actually.
Go for it.
I drove by the Warner Studios on my way to the tour the one time, and then I went back just to take a couple pictures of the one of the gates, just as a and you know where you could look through and you see the classic Warner Brothers water tower. And believe me,
Animaniacs.
If the scale is correct, the Animaniacs are giants.
Yes,
they're monsters. They're kaiju. It's crazy.
Wait, that's how big the tower is?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, it's not tiny, but I drove by a restaurant twice, and I looked at a smokehouse. Huh, that name rings a bell. I can't place it. It looks kind of groovy. It has like this late 40s, early 50s neon sign outside, and it looks kind of cool and everything. And it's like right across from one of the gates at Warner's. And I was like, oh, well, next time maybe, you know, I'll look into, you know, grabbing a bite there or something. Last week, long after I got home, I was reading something and I was like, I saw, you know, and blah, blah, blah from Smokehouse Productions. I was like, wait a minute, what? And then I go, wait a minute, George Clooney from Smokehouse? And then I did like a little bit of research. George Clooney owns that restaurant. Not that he's there every night, you know, checking receipts, but... That's the restaurant George Clooney owns, and it was used in a sequence in La La Land.
Which one?
The jazz club sequence.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I can beat that.
Okay. Because I was like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh God, I got to tell Natasha this at some point.
You never
and
told
she's
me
gonna
that.
She's going to be mad about me not going. Yeah, no. Well, this
but
was just
I
a couple of days ago I figured
I
it out.
I have a La La Land reference.
Oh, okay.
You know I have a La La Land reference.
Go.
I went dancing at the jazz club Le Caveau de la Huchette that shows up in the La La Land montage near the end of the movie.
Yes, you did.
That was a great night, by the way. Oh, yeah. I left my bag at home. I stuck my money and my phone in my boots. And I just went dancing, and it was amazing. Mm. I met these two wonderful gentlemen. One was English. Can't remember his name, but his friend's name was Tom. He was Scottish. We're friends now on Facebook. So you never know what can happen when you're in another country.
That's true. That's
and we,
true.
We just drank and danced, and then we left, and we went our own separate ways, and it was amazing.
It's so funny, because even the one night I went out to Burbank to meet our friend Ben.
Ben's
doing great. You know, he probably would like to be writing more and getting paid for it, but I think that's just common across our whole industry right now.
Agreed.
For journalists. But when I parked my car like a block away from the restaurant we were going to meet at, I, you know, park on a side street. I walk up to the main road and I look, and there's the LA Connection, which is an old, very long-lived comedy club that I can remember. They had a TV show in the late 70s, early 80s that my younger brother and I would sometimes sneak back downstairs to watch after my parents went to bed, called Mad Movies with the LA Connection, where they would kind of sit there, they'd edit like a public domain film down to like 30 minutes and then redub it.
Wow.
Yeah. It was similar to what Mystery Science Theater 3000 would eventually do, but instead of making fun of the actual movie, they kind of took the movie and reworked it. So like Night of the Living Dead became just Barbara running away from a zombie who had a telegram. And he was like, telegram. Oh, no, no, don't. I don't want it. It's always bad news. You know, and that was like one of the gags that they had in that, you know. So it was like, oh, crap. LA Connection. Awesome. You know, you just stumble over that stuff in Los Angeles because it's all so much drenched in history. I'm like driving over bridges and stuff going, I know I've probably seen this in like 9 movies.
I was going to say, was there a moment where you were just doing a drive-by really quick and it wasn't a big monument like for me, like seeing the Eiffel Tower or the Arc de Triomphe, but was there a moment where you saw something and you automatically recognized it just from a movie as you were driving past?
Unintentionally?
Yeah.
Driving by it? Well, I mean, it's not quite from a movie, but, you know, the Gail Ann Hurd's production office jumped out at me.
Location.
Oh, just as a location, though?
Because I had one. That's why I was asking if you did.
Yes and no. I mean, I didn't realize how many things had shot at the Biltmore until I like literally was in the old lobby, which they use in Beverly Hills Cop and Bachelor Party. And then I was like, wait a minute, this is the Bachelor part. And then I pulled out the book that you gave me and I'm like, flip, 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 flip. I'm like, oh my God. And so places like that. I know I walked by like a couple of other places, like when I was walking around within the vicinity of my hotel. And I was like, oh, I know I've seen that in something. And I know I had walked down Broadway just a little bit because I wanted to see the Eastern Building because it has that big clock. It's that beautiful green building, you know, with the golden letters and everything. And it features very prominently in the final act of the pilot for Moonlighting. So that was like kind of one of those, yeah, I need to see this. And it was undergoing some renovation and they had these black scrims up all around the whole top section. I was like, motherfucker. Yeah, so you do run into that. I mean, that wasn't the worst disappointment I had. And I'll tell that story in a minute.
My worst disappointment ended up with a great night.
Oh, okay.
So, because I couldn't get to Basilica de Sacré-Cœur on Sunday, I went on Monday after I had just got off the phone with you. After my whole walk on the Champs-Élysées, and you were like, oh, it's 1:30. I'm like, yeah, and I've done everything I wanted to do. And you're going, so the rest of the day is gravy.
Mm-hmm.
So I grabbed a cab, and it took me all the way up there. When I was done there, I inadvertently found the steps from, well, it's a very famous set of steps, but the first movie location that came into mind using it recently was John Wick 4.
Okay.
There's 200 stairs.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 20
flights. Did you have better luck getting up them than he did?
I didn't get up them. I came down them.
Oh, okay. Well, he did too, but I'm sure he took the easier way.
No, he was trying to get up to the Basilica. I was leaving the Basilica because I took a cab and then walk down.
Mm.
So as I was going through Mamat after that, I ended up at the cafe from Amelie.
Oh, I know that's a favorite of yours.
It is, and it doesn't look a damn thing like it does in the movie. No, it's okay, because to be honest, their beef bourguignon was worth it.
Okay, then.
The inside of the building was crap. The chairs were, the paint was peeling off of it. But it was kind of neon-y, and they were playing American 80s music. Mm-hmm. But at least the food was good, and that made it all worth it.
And how it used to look in that movie is still preserved in that movie.
Exactly.
So that's always nice. The history, I'm not a brand person because I'm crap when it comes to remembering dates, but the person who appreciates history, at least, is always, that's, I think, something that's grown out of my love of movies, is an appreciation of history.
Oh, and really quick, before I forget, my random encounter with a movie location that I was not expecting was on my first night. In between Le Grand Colbert and the cab that was taking me down to the Pathé Cinema, we passed by a place called Duluc Detective. That is the detective agency that was in Midnight in Paris. And one of the guys traveled back in time and got lost trying to keep an eye on Owen Wilson's character. But no, I drove right past it. And it looks the same as it did in the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, okay, so I've done my first day of like just futzing around, getting a vibe for the city and everything. The next day was I had my ticket for the Academy Museum. The Academy Museum and doing a one studio tour were like the two things I needed to do on my vacation and everything else and a couple of other smaller things. So I get to the Academy, and the reason I chose that day was because they were screening in the theater a brand new 4K restoration of Singin' in the Rain.
I remember you telling me about that. You were so excited.
I was. Well, A, it's a movie I love.
I know.
B, if I'm going to see a movie in Los Angeles to start off my vacation of movie nerddom, what better movie is it than Singing in the Rain, which is just a celebration of Hollywood's silent era and movies up until that point. Mm-hmm. And let's see it at the Academy on a brand new 4K restoration, which is stunning. Looked beautiful. Had a great time. Went up to the cafe on the first floor. There's like when you walk into the Academy Museum, there's like a little exhibit area to your left. And it's not there now because it closed in August, but they were showing the original Dijkstraflex camera that John Dijkstra invented for computer-controlled photography of X-Wing fighters, TIE fighters, the Millennium Falcon, all for the original first Star Wars film.
That was like me looking at the first Edison kinemascope or something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just this very clunky, weird-looking bit of technology with one of the actual shooting special effects models of the Millennium Falcon there too, which is like, yeah, baby. That's the thing that made everything change. You know, if Star Wars had just some really static, crummy, boring shots in that third act, that film never would have been as popular as it was. People were just seeing something brand new on the screen in terms of visual effects technology. And
you want to talk about visual effects technology. When I was at the Miles Museum, this is how much things can last and things can, you know, spill over time. They were showing on one of the screens of, Legacy was La Belle et la Bête, Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast film from the 40s. And they were showing a particular scene where Belle is running down a corridor and there are hands holding candelabras attached to the wall and they're moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know where I'm going with this, don't you?
Yeah.
That particular scene has been referenced in a more modern film. Maybe not so modern. It's 20 years old, but it still has an effect Joel Schumacher's Phantom of the Opera film.
Mm-hmm.
In sleep, he sang to me. In dreams, he came. In the title freaking song, the Phantom is leading Christine down this hallway through the mirror, and it is filled with nothing but these chandeliers held by hands connected to the wall that are moving.
Mm-hmm.
I've recently discovered, as people give Joel Schumacher crap about bat nipples, he is such a huge fan of classic cinema.
Oh, yeah.
And he references it constantly. The reveal section in Batman and Robin is ripped directly from Blonde Venus with Marlene Dietrich and Cary Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, do your history and shut the hell up.
I'm not a fan of his two Batman films.
Neither am I.
But I appreciate so much more of his other stuff.
Yeah, that scene always stuck out to me for a reason, and I didn't know what that reason was. I just knew that it seemed out of place in the movie that he was trying to tell. So when there is a visual style that seems out of place,
mm-hmm.
try to realize why it's out of place, and then research why it's out of place, and then you find out that it's a nod to history.
So, so getting back to me, though.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Fine. But what about something that is about both of us for a second?
Okay. This will get there.
You think you know where I'm going, don't
no,
you?
No, I know where I'm going with this.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So,
no, you go first.
I sit down in the cafe, mm-hmm. order some lunch.
Yep.
There's like tables and stuff, but I'm sitting at like a bar, and boom, person sits down next to me. I look over, and it's like the woman who introduced the movie, you know, that I just seen, who's like one of the head of programmers at the Academy Museum. She's like doing a couple little things and then puts that away and, you know, starts in on the food that she ordered. I kind of turn and I say, hey, thank you. You know, it was a great intro. I'm on vacation here. And this is like my first day out doing stuff. And it was literally my first thing. And, you know, I'm a movie nerd. So that, and yeah, we started a conversation. And, you know, and I kind of quizzed her as like, okay, I'm planning on going to the New Beverly this evening for a double feature. And she's like, oh, for Vanishing Point and Crazy Mary, Dirty Larry? I'm like, yeah. She goes, the prints that they're using our restoration prints that were done about 10, 15 years ago at Fox. Aww. And they're great. I'm like, cool. I've seen both those movies, but this is like tonight's the only time I could actually squeeze in doing a movie at that theater, which I've always – that was one of those bucket lists I need to go to see
Tarantino's film.
And so she's like, well, we're also showing something downstairs at the theater in about a half an hour. Were you sticking around for that? Or I was like, actually, I was going to spend my time doing all the stuff in the museum. She's like, oh, it's too bad because it's a brand new struck print from the original negative.
What was it?
Double Indemnity.
You fucking shit. You didn't do it.
I did not go.
Ugh.
See, I couldn't go because I know it's your all-time favorite movie. And I didn't want to go because I feel bad that you weren't there to enjoy that experience with
me. Not my all-time. Second all-time.
Second all-time. But yeah. It's one of... It's Look. Later on during the week, I drove up a massive, ridiculously twisty, windy, steep road twice to take video... To call you live on video chat so you could see the house from the movie.
And that's where I was going.
Okay.
But I'm pissed that you didn't go.
Well,
no, it's okay. It's okay. Considering our local it's like a concert house, but it used to be a cinema back in the day, and it's beautiful to see movies in.
Mm-hmm.
Is showing Double Indemnity in November, and I will finally get to see it on a big screen.
Oh, we will both go.
That will conclude seeing all three of my all-time favorite films on the cinema. Mm-hmm. Because I saw Black Swan when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
I saw When Harry Met Sally last year. And then finally, I will be able to see Double Indemnity this year.
But I do want to recommend, you know, the Academy Museum. Because I spent...
I'll get there. I want to see
it. 3.5 hours wandering around from floor to floor. And it was just amazing, everything that they had there. They had exhibits on the craft of storytelling. They have, you know, there's a little bit of self-congratulatory when you walk into the section about the Academy Awards. Literally, I walked into that, and there's like this huge table in the middle of the room. And on the edge of the table going all the way around are like the history of the Oscars. And on top of the table, stage, whatever you want to call it, are dummies with some of the like dresses and suits and tuxedos that were worn to various Oscar ceremonies over the years. And then on the TVs, on the walls, there's all these TVs showing various clips from various Oscar ceremonies. And then, but they kind of like slide, and like at each end of the wall, is like the picture will suddenly get bigger, and that's the one that they, you know, bring the sound in on. I literally walked in as Key was getting his Academy Award for Everything Everywhere All at Once, and
I would have melted.
It hit me. You know how emotional we were when we were watching that.
Oh God, we were so proud because we saw that film back in March.
Yeah.
And here we are almost a year later. Mm-hmm. We walked out of there knowing in March that it was going to win Best Actress and Best Supporting Actor and Best Supporting Actress and Picture. We knew it because when was the last time you were – it was the only time I've ever had that experience where you were in a crowd of critics and audience members alike, and by the time the movie was done, you had a full audience applause. When was the last time you experienced that?
That's hard to say. I can't, yeah, outside of like a festival screening where you know they're bringing out the director, so everybody's going to applaud the end of the movie.
No,
just like a critic screen or anything like that. I can't even remember.
It's the only time I've ever experienced that.
Yeah.
And it was transcendent.
Yeah. So that was kind of like a big kick in the gut. I was like, oh my God. Yeah. You know, and as you just saw right now, I kind of...
Yeah, you got a little teary.
I welled up right then. And then, like, over to the side is that... you've probably seen it in, like, videos about the Academy. They have that, like, little anteroom with actual Oscar statues.
Yes.
From various people that were...
And Hattie McDaniels is gone, but they have the spot.
It's an empty spot for that, which was moving in and of itself.
It's beautiful.
And then... You know, three over is one of the Academy Awards that were handed out to the special effects crew for Star Wars for the piece of equipment I just saw downstairs like 40 minutes earlier. It's, you know, it was incredible. They had a great exhibit on John Waters, the Pope of Trash. They had some really cool things about how films are made. There was one alcove. I literally walked in, and they were basically kind of deconstructing Raiders of the Lost Ark, the opening scene in the temple where, you know.
Yeah, with the boulder and all that, yeah.
Yeah, from the sack of sand going down, you know, to him escaping. And they first play it with the actual production audio that was shot on the set. You can hear Spielberg going, okay, shake that, you know, and, okay, now Harris, and you run, you know, you hear all that, and it's crazy. And then they play that scene over and over again, and they build it up with each layer of sound, the music. You just see that scene once with the music. Mm. You hear it once with just the of the darts coming out of the wall and everything, and then they finally play it in full, and it was narrated. And I literally walk in right as they're starting, but it was like maybe 30 seconds in, and I hear the narrator, and I go, oh, that's Ben Burtt. Cool. Ben Burtt is like the guy who sound designed Star Wars, Raiders, all the Star Wars movies. You know, he's worked for Lucasfilm forever. And I've heard him in so many interviews just being a nerd over the years that I dare say probably 1 in 1,000 people, you know, maybe 1% of the people in that entirety of the museum could have walked in and go, oh, that's Ben Burtt, you know, outside of the people who work there. And then I found out like he's on the Academy Museum's board. So it was an easy get for him for that.
I'm sure.
Yeah, but it was amazing. And the other thing I kind of want to... Okay, and then I went to see the double feature at the New Bev. Both films were from like the early 70s, criminals on the run in their cars. And it was funny because the guy who introduced the film came up, both of the films came up and said, hey, this was originally out as a double feature, but Crazy Mary, Dirty Larry played first, but we're flipping that order. So we're going to see Vanishing Point first tonight. There'll be a 15-minute intermission to go out and get some popcorn and stuff, or in my case, buy a t-shirt. And quick survey, who has not seen both of these films? A lot of hands went up. And I had seen both, but so I was just like, okay, cool. And he goes, okay, then I think you're going to be in for a great treat tonight. Now, without spoiling things, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry ends on a very similar note that Vanishing Point does.
Mm-hmm.
If you know one movie, then I might have just spoiled the other movie for you a little bit, but I would recommend seeing both of them for different reasons. They're both really good films.
I've never seen either. I've never even heard of either, to be honest. Okay. Sorry.
That's all right. So the first movie plays, and Vanishing Point, I think, is the one that's a little bit more known. I think it's on Criterion. And, you know, everybody gets up. Wow, that was amazing. We all go get, you know, popcorn or t-shirts. People step outside for a quick smoke, come back in. Second movie starts playing. It's going great. And we get to the end, and that moment hits. The place went nuts. They were just like, wait, what the fuck? Did we just see the same movie twice? You know, they just couldn't believe it. And I just sat there and I laughed. I was so happy with, like, oh my God, that was really a fun experience. So that was great. That was like probably, and those were the only three movies I saw was that day that I went to see actual movies in Los Angeles. I would recommend going to the New Bev. I would recommend the taco place next door if you're hungry beforehand. 1986 tacos. They're really good. And also, amazingly, that area of Los Angeles, incredibly cheap meter parking. I think I paid like a, I don't know, like $2 or $3 for like 3.5 hours. That's insane.
Not bad.
Yeah, it was like, okay, cool. And it's a nice old school theater. If you ever have memories of going to movies in like the 70s and early 80s, or if you want to know what it was kind of like going to movies before the rise of stadium seating and assigned seating and Barca loungers and everything else and having food brought to you.
Actually, both of my movies, I didn't have any of that.
Oh, it was a kind of a flat or the bow curve a little bit. Where the screen is here, and then it's kind of like...
So the bow curve was at the Pathé, and it was not completely flat, but very lightly leveled.
Okay.
At, can't remember the name of the cinema, but the one I saw, the Big Heat in. Mm-hmm. What I mean is, you couldn't order your food to your seat or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I have two small questions.
Okay.
The first one is, what was the best experience that you had on your vacation where there were no movies involved?
Oh, okay. I would say just the driving around that first day after I had gotten my rental car.
Mm-hmm.
When it was just like driving around, getting to feel the vibe of the city a little bit and noticing things like shifting neighborhoods, and I can be in one section of the town and then I can drive, you know, like only a mile, mile and a half away into another section of town, and the gas prices would be $1.25 more a gallon.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. That was insane. I mean, so much of my trip, I, you know, kind of had geared towards movie stuff. So it wasn't like I loved the breakfast place I found, Egg Slut.
Yeah.
It was great. I was disappointed that they were out of t-shirts when it was time to go.
That would have been a great one to have. Well, I'm sure you could look them up online and possibly order one.
That's possible too, yeah.
You could still wear Egg Slut.
I just ordered two t-shirts from a Seattle museum that is doing a thing about the locally produced but nationally known sketch comedy show Almost Live. They're doing a display and a reunion of the cast. And the tickets for that, though, because it was so popular in Seattle for the 15 years that it ran, tickets sold out in like 2 minutes.
Jesus.
Yeah. I was like, well, I'm not going to Seattle if I can't get in to see that. But let me see if the museum. And yeah, so I ordered two T-shirts. But one's a gift for a friend.
With mine, I can't say Maxime's on my last night because Maxime's was in Midnight in Paris.
Yes.
So the food there was amazing and I had the best Armagnac of my life, courtesy of two wonderful French gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot say the cigar bar that I found behind a barber shop.
Nice.
No, I'm seriously, I had to go inside the barber shop and through like a bookcase to find this place. Ooh. Yeah, it was like a speakeasy cigar bar. Actually, my best moment was this little cafe around the corner from my hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go there every morning and I would get an espresso and a cigarette. You know this story.
Yes.
I got to know a few of the patrons there and I got to know one of the, I don't know, she's an owner or she's just one of the managers. Her name is Agnes there. And she was so sweet that I ended up taking her a bouquet of roses on the day before I left. And I just cried and cried and cried. And she looked at me and she's like, you'll come back to Paris. And I'm like, oh, I don't know when. It took me so long to get here the first time. But day broke my heart. And I just come back from the hammam too, which was, I can't say that was a non-movie experience because it was the exact hammam they used in Emily in Paris. Not realize that until I got there.
It's so funny because there was a couple of times, you know, I referenced it jokingly when I arrived at my hotel, walked in and realized exactly what room in the building I was standing in and said, anybody seen a ghost? But there were a couple of other times where I just kind of got overwhelmed by the moviedom, by the movie memory. Like when I went up to Griffith Observatory, literally in Griffith Park there, like 100 yards down the hill, basically, from the observatory is a tunnel. It's just a short little tunnel, maybe 50 yards at most long, that cuts through the mountain. And you've seen this tunnel in a number of movies.
North by Northwest?
No.
Oh, okay,
it's not that.
Phew.
But we've seen it in Back to the Future. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, okay.
Barton Fink. You know, a number of places. And, you know, it's the tunnel that Eddie drives through to go to Toontown. And literally, as I'm coming up in the car, as soon as I hit that tunnel...
You didn't.
I started singing Smile,
God
Darnius. I just couldn't help it. I was like, look, I'm alone, but I'm going to be goofy about this. I don't care. It's for my own amusement. Because, you know, I love that movie. It made, you know, and I just was like, well, what else would one sing when driving into Toontown?
No, I get that. I had an overwhelming effect like that, but it was not like a fun effect like that. It was as I was walking the one morning from my hotel to up by the Seine, I passed through a cemetery and it was filled with so many people. It was ridiculous. I didn't even get to all of them. In fact, I went looking for Serge Gainsbourg and Jane Birkin, and I couldn't find them. Yeah, because they were on the other opposite side of the aisle.
I never even got to like Hollywood Forever, but as I was driving from my hotel to the car rental place on the day I was leaving, I drove by it finally. I was like, oh, there's Hollywood Forever. I have no time at all to stop. This sucks. You know, it's because I'm looking at my watch, you know.
It just happened to be on my way.
Yeah. Leaving lots of cushion time in case, you know, there are long lines or whatever.
I did get to pay my respects to American-born French New Wave star Jean Seberg.
Mm-hmm. I know that was important to you.
That one was a good one. Henri Langlois. Mm-hmm. Who created La Cinémathèque Française and therefore immortalized so much of cinema history from around the world. And not exactly cinema history, but definitely history for us. I paid my respects and they are buried together. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, people forget who is buried with her, so much so that there are feminist icons inscribed and chalked all over the gravestone. That they forget that, you know, she's buried with one of the greatest existential philosophers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the feminist icon has just completely enveloped him.
I wonder what he would have to say about that. He might have some very existential, well, that's the way it is, kind of a...
Possibly.
Yeah. I hit a couple of other places along the way. The one, though, that I was the most important to me to getting to outside of the Biltmore itself, and you're going to roll your eyes. You already know what's coming. The Sepulveda Dam. Because it was used for the end credit march in Buckaroo Banzai, which is one of my all-time favorite films. It's 40 years old. Next month will be 40 years since I saw it in the cinema. And
I'm going to ask a really stupid question here, or it might be, you know, right on the mark. Is that the same dam where they shot the race from Greece?
I believe so.
I figured, because that's where I recognized it from. And I think I also saw it from a scene from Stranger Things from the last season.
I don't know if it was from Stranger Things, because that would have mean them schlepping from Georgia, where they normally shoot that movie show, out to Los Angeles, but maybe. I could see the Duffer brothers saying, hey, it's 80s. We got to shoot something here. Because it's also been in Escape from New York and a couple of other movies. But that was like kind of one of those, for me, I promised myself 40 years ago, one day I will visit that location. And I had to like hike through scrub brush and climb up and over the dike and down the other side. And I think I might have been in an area that might have been trespassing. I don't know. But no one stopped me. And there are other people who kind of came in and out. But that was another one of those, oh my God, I am here moments for me. And then, of course, I took the Turner Classic Movies TCM Warner Brothers tour, which was a blast. They kind of take you out onto the back lot. You get to see like the town square, and oh look, out on the side of the town hall standing set was the library entrance from Rebel Without a Cause. This house here was used in so many things. This house was used in so many things. And then you can walk in and around it, and you kind of see where it's like stripped down until they need to like come in and set decorate it. But if you look up, you see like these giant ductworks for the air conditioning, because once you get like all the film lights in there, it becomes like unbearably hot. We kind of walked around, saw, you know, the exterior for Abbott Elementary that they have there. It was amazing. There were so many things. They point out, oh, over there was where we used to have our standing Western sets, but they burned down in the 90s. So it's parking now. And you're driving along, these little bungalows all of a sudden are all in a row, and they're like, this is where various production companies have their bungalows. Everybody who works on the lot has an assigned parking spot. And take a look at some of the names outside of these production bungalows. And I sent you that picture of George Clooney's parking spot.
George
was not there that day. The TCM tour takes you into the actual prop house, and they walk you around, and they're pointing out like, here, you know, there's just like stuff stacked everywhere. It's not like a museum. It's just like, it's a working prop house. There's like walls of like 1980s princess phones in every color imaginable.
I know you got really excited about that. You're telling me.
That was crazy. I was just like, you know, I took pictures and I sent them to you. There's the hallway of presidents, and it seemed like where they had like all these portraits of various fake movie presidents. And then there's like all these podiums and stuff. So there's like three or four different podiums from like Westworld and stuff, or not Westworld, West Wing, excuse me. And it was amazing to do all of that. And then at the end of that, there's still like a walkthrough self-guided tour museum component, which was really fun, which also had a sound mixing demo. But that sound mixing demo was from Gravity.
Oh, really?
Yes, from right when they start to
You're going to be shocked here. Fixing... I've never seen Gravity.
I thought you saw Gravity with me. Nope. I'm sorry.
When did Gravity come out?
Oh, yeah, I guess not. No.
No.
Sorry. Oops. But
I just watched your face just figure that out.
Yeah, sorry about that. But it starts where they're like outside of the shuttle doing the routine repair on the satellite, and then the asteroid or the meteorite start hitting and all hell breaks loose, and they layer everything through, and it's like amazing. And you're in like this ridiculous sound room that's like just peak sound mixing is like when it's all hitting you in the head, and you go, oh yeah, this is why, you know, this is a very delicate and, you know, accurate science and art all at once. It was amazing. They have like a little setup that does the force perspective thing from Lord of the Rings. So if you were there with somebody else, you could sit at one side of the table and be Gandalf. They could sit at the other side of the table and look like they're a hobbit, kind of a thing.
Now, that's a section I would love to do because I'd love to learn that that process in order so I can fucking recreate it. No, I mean, that's a practical effect that I don't
that
feel
works amazing.
People use anymore and could probably be a hell of a lot easier and a hell of a lot cheaper than going ahead and using special effects, guys.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And,
if you know how to do it. So learn.
Yeah. And there's so many things, a lot of costume displays, a lot of prop displays, model displays from various Warner Brothers films throughout the decades. It's absolutely amazing. And that's one of those. They didn't pay me to say this. They didn't give me a free tour to say this. But I'm recommending if you're looking at doing, I mean, I want to do the MGM tour, too, at some point. And Universal Studios is okay, but I feel, from what I hear, it's a bit more theme parky. Mm. You're not actually seeing the working studio.
Yeah.
But Warner Brothers, every tour can be different because if you get there on a day where they're shooting, you know, something in one part of the outside sets, they have to go around. I mean, and you can also go, hey, I wanted to see Termite Terrace where the old animation artists work. And the guy was like, yeah, sure, we can go over there. And then, you know, we drive over there. You know, I'm glad I asked to that we could do that. And then you realize you look across the parking lot, the little parking lot area, and you're like, oh, across from that is the production bungalows for the Night Court revival. And some of those parking spots are full because
people are shooting.
Well, there was a writer's room was starting to reconvene because it was the middle of June. So some people were there to start writing the new season.
And, I completely get that because you just mentioned that Universal is probably going to be a lot more theme parky. And my brain went, yeah, but I would love to see, not that they would have anything really, anything that they have from like the old Universal Monster section. Yeah.
I wonder what they do have in terms of existent stuff. Lot. Yeah, I mean,
unless it's gonna be like masks and stuff on just heads.
Yeah, it's funny too because I mean some of that stuff the studios and the Academy bought back into Hollywood from prop auctions. Well, for example, at the Academy Museum, they have like this one little alcove for Casablanca. And they have Sam's piano. They have Laszlo's Letters of Transit. They have like one or two other things. And I sat there and I looked at him. I went, I saw all of this stuff at a preview day at a Bonhams auction. In New York City. I have a picture of me standing next to this piano, 10 years ago or whatever.
Well, it's interesting to see how, like, some of that stuff goes into private hands. Disney, if you're listening to this, please bring back, what was it called, prop?
Yeah, the prop show.
Yeah, that was amazing, and I really enjoyed watching a lot of the behind the scenes, particularly on the Narnia episode and the Mary Poppins episode to see where some of that stuff ends
up. I really
up.
Liked the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids episode.
Aww.
Because they got
Rick Moranis
to show up for that. And I was like, my God, I don't think anybody's seen a Rick Moranis sighting in 20 years. This is amazing.
But because of that, like I started doing some research and seeing where things go. And actually, when Debbie Reynolds passed away, a lot of things were getting cleared out. And one of the things that almost ended up at a Salvation Army was Audrey Hepburn's dress from Sabrina.
Oh, my God.
And it was found. Thank God it was found last minute. Mm-hmm. And I think that ended up somewhere in, like, the Academy Museum or one of the museums. It was donated, but it was just, it was that close. It was in a box to go to the Salvo. And it was like, when I read that article, I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. That is Givenchy iconic white and black dress with the overskirt that... Mm-hmm. How the fuck does that just end up almost going to a Salvation Army where any old person could end up chopping it up?
That's true. Yeah. And for every item like that that gets recognized and saved, how many kind of do disappear into history? And again, the history side of me is like,
Oh, no, no, no. So actually, oh, shit. What's her name? The burlesque queen, Dita Von Teese.
Oh, Dita Von Teese.
Does through Architectural Digest on YouTube, gives a tour of her house. Mm-hmm. And on one of the walls, she has one of Gypsy Rose Lee's original costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she has like Natalie Wood's one costume from when she played Gypsy. So it's impressive to see like where some of those pieces end up based off of what you're willing to do to obtain them.
As a collector, I think most collectors...
you would love watching her house, not just for film or burlesque history, but she has so many unique pieces from the turn of the century and from the 30s and 40s. Just her furniture alone, her taxidermy, her kitchen appliances, down to her boudoir furniture and her clothing. It's just, you would just eat it up because she lives... her time period.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people who collect, serious collectors, consider themselves not owners of that, of those pieces.
Trustees.
But trustees. They know that at some point they're going to pass it on to somebody else who will appreciate it and care for it and preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And on occasion something, you know, like the Debbie Reynolds things happens. But I think she was just a fan of stuff and she collected stuff. She didn't like make shadow boxes and put things in or dress dummies and put them in a corner like I see on like some displays of prop collectors on Facebook and stuff like
that. But the difference is when people do that and they just throw things into a box and put it off somewhere instead of shadow boxing it, people who are ignorant of what that is come across it and they just... because they don't know,
well,
they could end up destroying.
That's why you're the executrix on my will. So,
and then there are also the worry as a vintage fan myself. Mm. This is a huge worry: is the care for the fabrics from moths, from dry rot, from mold, like. Putting them in shadow boxes and stuff like that are better ways of caring for them, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So recently I discovered a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful 40s dress. And I wanted to buy it. And I found it at like a Salvation Army.
Ooh.
And you know why I didn't buy it?
It was half fallen apart.
It had been sitting on a hanger for far too long than it should have been. And Rich understands what I'm about to get to here.
Wire hanger?
I don't know if it was wire hanger, but it was a hanger because...
I'm about to go Joan Crawford here.
The shoulders had been stretched beyond repair. Because it was chiffon.
Oh, jeez.
It was a chiffon... top. And so the weight of the dress, it was actually quite similar to my In a Lonely Place gown.
Okay.
The top of the chiffon had been stretched. There was no lining. There was nothing to bear the weight of all those layers and layers and layers of gown underneath.
Oh, man.
The damn thing had been so stretched out and destroyed, there was no fixing it.
Ugh. That's...
And it broke my heart.
Mm, that's breaking my heart right now.
I've even started realizing that with some of my own pieces. Mm-hmm. Like, I was told several years ago, don't put sweaters on hangers. And yeah, I knew that was the case. And I put, I'm going to tell you which one, pink cable knit bell sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no.
But the thing was, for some reason, it didn't affect the shoulders.
Oh, good. Is it okay? Is it still in good condition?
Oh, no, it's fucked.
Oh, fine.
For some reason, because it was on a hanger, mm-hmm. the sleeves, the weight and gravity of the sleeves mm-hmm. stretched. So now I put it on me and I...
Your hands disappear.
It's about 6 or 7 inches past my fingertips. And I'm literally, I could just... Floom, 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 floom.
It's kind of a 60s, you know, flowing vibe thing.
There's flowing and then there is flipper.
Okay. well. So,
yes. When I see things like the Debbie Reynolds Sabrina costume, it scares the shit out of me inside. Because that is Hollywood history. And if it was just a random piece of clothing that wasn't as iconic as that dress is, that apart from the Breakfast at Tiffany's black dress, that is Audrey Hepburn's most iconic piece in her entire career. Mm-hmm. And that could have just ended up at a random Salvation Army and just torn apart by some rando who didn't know what it was.
True. Thankfully, though,
it had been
we sick. Have... the museum in Paris. We have the Academy Museum. We have studios recognizing that they need to take care of their own history because it's important, not just on a balance sheet, but
to our future,
to our culture, to our future, so we can look where we were and where we're going. And that's what we did on our summer vacation.
Yes, it was. Honest, guys, get yourself out there, see the world.
Take a trip or
two. Experience history and films around you. Trust me, you won't be disappointed.
True.
And I think that just about wraps us up for, wow, it has been a while.
It is one of our longer episodes, yes.
And honest, I
we could
don't
keep
feel
going.
Like I should cut a damn thing out of this.
I'm
because
not.
It is, no, I'm not saying you
couple,
should.
A couple of ums and a pause or two, but.
It may be one of our longest episodes, but there was so much that we wanted to bring to you and so much to say, get yourself out there and see the world.
And so many other stories that we both could tell from our trips, but we'll dribble and drab those in as we go along through this whole next season of podcast episodes.
Remember, you can find us online, hold on, at bigpicturepod.com, and you can find us on, are we on Spotify yet?
Yes.
Yeah, we are on Spotify, and Stitcher, and mm-hmm. Google Play.
And all the places you can normally find podcasts.
So just find the link in the show notes post, or head directly there, search and hit subscribe. And that was bigpicturepod.com.
Yes. And
if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners.
We will be back next time with more news, reviews. And I think we're going to do a retro review for the 20th anniversary of...
Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow?
Yes, indeed. Another favorite of mine, and I think a movie that's been a little bit unjustly overlooked, but one that I think has a very important place in cinema history.
I would absolutely agree with that, particularly with visual effects.
Yes.
And I would say that's all right here on the Big Picture Podcast.
Hooray for Hollywood. That's gooey, ballyhooly Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan. And any shop girl can be a top girl if she pleases the tired businessman. Hooray for Hollywood! You may be homely in your name. To be an actor, see Mr. Factor, you make your kisser look good.